Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Everyone, and welcome to yet another compelling episode of 100 Words or Less, the podcast. I say compelling because, you know what, I can put whatever adjective I want in there. Maybe you would put terrible. Maybe I would put awesome, interesting, engaging, insightful. I could keep going, but I won't. I'm your host, Ray Harkins, and the guest this week is Mr. Steve Moore. So Steve Moore is a soundtrack composer, and he also plays in a band called Zombie, Z-O-M-B-I, and that is where I first discovered him. I was extremely excited that he was interested in doing this interview, just because I respect his music greatly, and honestly, I think he's kind of a little under the radar for most independent music listeners, and I want to change that. I want you to be familiar with his stuff. So more on him. Let's get some stuff out of the way that from a business perspective I want to let you in on and whatever else. So first of all, visit the show's website, 100 Words Podcast. And last episode, I put out a call for people interested in working alongside of me in regards to new shows, new endeavors. So if you, the listener, have some sort of audio editing experience from, you know, Pro Tools, GarageBand, that sort of stuff, I would love to hear from you. A few people have reached out and I'm kind of, you know, talking to them, seeing what's up. So if you have experience in that, please email me, 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. Now, to be clear, this isn't talking about producing or editing this particular show. Tom Richfield is locked into that role until basically he keels over and passes this mortal coil. He will be attached to this show. So this is for future interesting, exciting, engaging things that I am hopefully going to be launching soon. So I would love to work with more creative and talented people because, you know, I mean, I'm okay at editing, but I know that that is not my strong suit. So I would rather work with a person who's pretty killer at it. So anyways, I'm tired. I've been running around like a mad person because I got signed up for jury duty. And secretly, I've always been really, really interested in being on a jury. And I am. I'm currently, as you listen to this, more likely than not, if you're listening to it on the release date or a few days after we put this show out, I'm on a trial. I'm sitting there with 11 other jurors. I am talking about a case. And of course, I cannot divulge any information on that case because that would, compromise me as a juror or whatever. But to say it is interesting and exciting is an understatement. It's awesome. I know a lot of people look at jury duty and are just like, oh my gosh, this is like the worst thing ever. I have to wait around. It's inconvenient. I have to, take the day off work or whatever. It's created a lot of stress for me in regards to trying to balance my own day job versus what's happening with the podcast and then also what's happening in this jury duty case. But I wouldn't trade it at all. It is awesome. It is so interesting to see people work. And I say, the defense lawyers, the state's prosecutor, like it's just so engaging to watch people work and craft a narrative and lead people down certain roads and stories to tell. And I love it. Like, honestly, I had like one day off this week and I was bummed at that. I wanted to be in the courtroom. So I could definitely see where experiencing it once is kind of like, oh yeah, I would do that again. And I'm really, really interested to see what the jury deliberation room is going to be like, because I think that is going to probably be the most, I wouldn't say excruciating, but maybe difficult part to get 12 people to agree on one thing. That is not an easy thing. So anyways, I just wanted to let you in on that. And October will be another theme month. I will release that information right now. I will not tell you the theme, but basically all the guests are tied together in some capacity. And you'll understand the framework in which I'm speaking to them. So, and we have some amazing shows coming up in September. It's cool because I feel the show is in a flow right now where I am able to speak to people who might be a little left of center of what you may expect, and I love that. I love the fact that you are engaging with it. Like the feedback I got from a few episodes ago from the Alex Goldman from Reply All podcast, the feedback I got from that show is incredible. And this is a person who isn't necessarily like playing in bands, doing record labels, all that sort of stuff. But he still applies the principles that he learned from the independent music scene and into his day-to-day life. And it's awesome. So I really appreciate that you, the listener, are listening to every episode. That is extremely important to me because you'll start to see the narrative that is created with all of these people and all of their experiences. And basically, this is a long-winded way of me saying thank you very much for letting me introduce you to people, ideas, music, all these other things that you might not have necessarily been exposed to. I'm not saying that I'm the arbiter of good taste, but all I'm doing is exposing you to stuff that I've tripped across that I feel is compelling in some capacity, which brings me to Steve Moore. Like I said, he might be off the beaten path for most people who are, listening to whatever punk or hardcore, but this guy is steeped in it. He's played in bands for years. And like I said, I got exposed to him via his band Zombie, who has put out a lot of records on Relapse, who is a notorious metal label, but also does a lot of creative releases in regards to the stuff that they put out. They don't just stick to one strain, so to speak. And so basically, once I started to get just obsessed with horror movies and zombie movies and all that ilk, probably when I was about, 15, 16, that's when I really took a deep dive into it, like doing research, buying books. And then in my later teens, early 20s, I just became obsessed with it, like VHS tape trading, even when DVDs were readily available. I got really, really nerdy about it. And then I started to get into the soundtracks of these things. So Steve Moore and his band Zombie were basically creating soundtracks to a movie that didn't exist, but they were using real live instruments and then performing and touring. And so I got to see Zombie play more than once. And it was such an awesome experience because, it's basically watching these dudes create these soundscapes, a horror movie that is in your head. And Steve has gone on to be very prolific and hardworking in the soundtrack composition standpoint as well. There's an incredible movie called The Guest, who if at any point when you're listening to this, just press pause, hop into Netflix, watch the movie. The movie's incredible, and Steve scored that movie. It's since come out on vinyl through the beautiful people over at Death Waltz / Mondo. Yeah, just great stuff. Steve is an awesome guy, and this conversation definitely shows you that. And we went to a lot of interesting places. Steve was definitely, very reflective when I was speaking to him. And he definitely shares a lot of things that I think were, most people can find relevance to. So without further ado, here's my discussion with Steve, and I will talk to you after we are done. Basically, when Zombie first put out your guys' first EP on Relapse, Cosmos, I was immediately like, yo, what's this? Like, this is really good. And I was excited because obviously my love for soundtracks in general existed, but I didn't know that I would ever be able to see a band in the context of independent music be able to kind of like play it live, you know? Most of my friends were really perplexed by me being like so overly into your band. They were just like, dude, really? Yeah, like this?
I can relate to that. We had that a lot too.
Sure. Because I mean, it's like, you know, I'm coming from the context of a punk and hardcore kid. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh dude, I'm super into this like atmospheric horror movie-esque soundtrack. Is it one of those things where you, maybe you can reflect on that time or even currently now where are you surprised like when you see, I guess, younger kids that are into your band and kind of, you know, what Zombie is doing in general?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, I think it really kind of still shocks me that anybody cares at all, really.
Sure.
We kind of, very intentionally found a very dark and dusty corner of the music world to inhabit. And the fact that we're not alone there anymore is a little off-putting.
Right. How did the partnership with Relapse first exist? Like, did they just randomly contact you and it kind of just kind of sprung out from there?
No, I contacted them actually. Because I was really into at the time and still, I really like, I liked a lot of the release things that they put out. Relapse used to have a sub label called Release, where they dedicated more towards like dark ambient type of stuff, sort of like they put out Vidna, Obmana, stuff like that.
Did Merzbo release some stuff on there as well?
Yeah, and it was focused on this sort of dark new age kind of sound. And we really just had no idea who to turn to. We when we first started playing, we just play shows at the various Pittsburgh, punk spaces and whatever. The reaction we got, just sort of told us that this could be bigger than this. So we should try to find an actual label, an established label to put this out. Also, we're just not very savvy in that sense. Like, I don't think either of us had the initiative to like press a bunch of albums, and we did self-release a couple things before Relapse, but they were like seriously limited to like 50 copies,
right.
We wanted to hand it over to an established label that would maybe know what to do with us, but we just had no idea who, so I contacted anybody I had been in touch with, anybody that I knew that I thought might be a good fit. But I sent Relapse a demo thinking that it would be maybe something interesting for their sub label Release. And technically Cosmos is a split release between Relapse and Release. So they, I think we might've been one of the last albums that they put out on the sub label. And then that they closed that up. Basically because I think the way they were thinking was there's really no need to keep that stuff separate anymore because it was big enough at that point. Enough people were buying those records. But they really kind of just jumped on it. They were really into it. They saw that that our music would be compatible to the people that, they have a very loyal fan base. There are people that just buy the albums that Relapse puts out.
Yeah, no, for sure. There's definitely that... without putting it in too much in marketing terms, like that brand allegiance, where it's like people obviously trust the stamp of approval that they give bands. And I think that, that obviously benefited you guys because people were willing to walk down that path of like, well, I don't know if I necessarily be into this, but if it came out on Relapse, like, of course I'll give it the time of day.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, and that's the type of labels that we were approaching where like, I'd been speaking to, Greg at Ipecac Records, mm-hmm. Which is another one of those types of labels that they put out whatever they want, and whatever they put out, their people eat it up.
Right.
And that's kind of what we were hoping for, because how do you market? I mean, now I guess it's different now. I'm still kind of looking at things from the you know, the 2002 perspective. But now, you know, I think it'd be a lot easier. There's a market for that kind of stuff. But back then it was sort of like you just kind of had to hope that people were open-minded enough to give it a shot, to give it a chance, you know?
Yeah. No. This is something I was going to address a little bit later, but it's appropriate since I think you bring it up, where it was one of those things where, like, another thing that attracted me to you guys was the fact that, you know, you essentially toured like a punk and hardcore band, because I mean, not only was that, I presume, kind of the scene that you came from, like you said, playing, you know, I'm sure the Mr. Roboto Project in Pittsburgh and all those other punks.
Five shows were at Roboto Project.
Cool.
And the bands that we were in before Zombie were pretty much regulars. The Roboto Project, the various Manny Theiner venues like the Millvale Industrial Theater, the Garfield Artworks, you know, that was the scene that we were very much part of when we were just starting out.
Right. And I think that even though, like you said, you're reflecting on this time where it would obviously be easier for Zombie to be, you know, birthed into the world from a release perspective, but I still think that the context in which you were touring would still be completely foreign, you know, like, because to this day, I can't really point to a band that did what you guys did, where it was like you took the, you know, like I said, the ethics of what you would do in the punk and hardcore world and applied it to something sonically different, but you still applied the same touring principles to it, to where it was, I just thought it was so inherently unique because of that.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's an aspect of Zombie that people who are just finding out about us now don't really get. They missed out on that. The fact that, you know, we used to do close to 200 shows a year, and when we'd play, we'd haul out, you know, 2 6-10 cabinets with 1800 watt power amps that we'd run our keyboard through those. And then I had a Sun Coliseum and a big bass cabinet. You know, it was loud and it was aggressive live. You know, it didn't, whatever it ended up sounding like on the record, if you were to come out and see us live, it would be a different experience. It would be much more like a rock band coming from this sort of like punk or no wave or post rock kind of place, just sort of, you know, drawing from a different set of influences.
Right, right. No, there's definitely no subtlety in regards to what you were doing live.
And we didn't listen to Gorilla Biscuits, but that doesn't mean that we didn't feel some kinship to that type of scene, you know?
Right, right.
You know, and in the 90s, I went to hardcore shows. You know, I was real big into that type of thing.
Sure.
You know, we growing up in Pittsburgh, we didn't quite get as many of the shows there, but we'd drive to Lancaster to see, you know, Earth Crisis and Integrity and, you know, or Akron, you know, the various different Rust Belt cities that these bands really thrived in.
Yeah, I mean, that will segue perfectly into, you were born and raised in Pittsburgh, and that's kind of where you cut your teeth as far as like getting exposed to, you know, bands and music in general.
Mm-hmm.
What was your family structure like? Brothers and sisters and like mom and dad in the house?
Yeah. My parents are still together. I have a sister who's 6 years younger than me. I actually grew up in Monroeville, which is where they filmed Dawn of the Dead. And that was like the mall where they shot that movie was where I'd go on the weekends to hang out. And then, you know, in high school, I'd you know, get jobs at the different stores and work there. And, you know, it was a very normal childhood. Aside from the fact that I was sort of obsessed with these horror movies, but in Pittsburgh, that's part of the culture. That's a huge point of pride in the city.
Right. No, it's true.
It was hard growing up in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. It was hard not to be somehow influenced by that stuff.
The many years I toured with my bands, one time forcing the rest of the guys in the band to be like, dude, we got to go to Monroeville. And they were like, you're such a nerd. I'm like, dude, but it's the mall. And so, yeah, I can understand the how weird it must be where it's like, oh, wow, that seminal movie was filmed at the, you know, the mall where I worked in the food court or whatever.
Yeah. And to drive, you know, to drive to my grandmother's house from where I lived, you had to go past the airport that they shot the helicopter decapitation scene. You drove past all like the houses that they used for the outdoor scenes when like there's like a pretty a pretty fun scene where there's like sort of a bunch of like, you know, they're flying the helicopter over, and I think it's supposed to be Johnstown or Philadelphia, and they make a joke about those rednecks down there probably loving this. And then there's a little scene where the, you know, a bunch of guys in flannels, and they're drinking beer, and there's a bonfire, and they're kind of using the zombies in the distance as target practice, and, you know, really actually having a good time with the whole thing. But that was my neighborhood, you know.
Right. So what kind of kid did you find yourself being as you were, you know, getting into high school and kind of developing your own identity? Because I presume that a lot of people, especially with, you know, what you're doing now and kind of the solitary nature of music composition from a score perspective, I imagine most people will be like, oh, yeah, you're that loner kid that hangs out in the corner. Did you find yourself being that like in high school, or was that just completely an image that's thrust upon you at this point?
No, I mean, I would say that I was, you know, through junior high, probably the beginning of high school, until I'd been like very musical, since I was a really young kid. My dad had like an old Krumar synthesizer that I would play around with when I was, you know, really young, like basically as soon as I could stand and pluck notes out on a keyboard. I didn't really fully submit to music until high school. I started playing bass guitar in, I guess, 10th grade. And then from there, it was like, okay, now I play bass guitar. I want to be in a band. And then that's how I met people. And, you know, honestly, from that point on, every friendship in my life is a direct result of my involvement in music. It just took over my life, and then there was this vast network of people who were now suddenly interested in me, and it changed everything. You know, it showed me that this is my place. This is what I should be doing.
Right. Like this is you found a community that was obviously accepting of whatever weird stuff you were into.
Yeah, I mean, I weighed about 90 pounds, you know, and I was just not athletic. I was shy. There was just no other option for me than music. Right.
I like how you put that. You're like, well, this is kind of the last resort, so I'll just go ahead and plug into this and see if this works. Oh, it works.
Yeah, well, and the bass guitar, like I played saxophone in the band, you know, since like fourth grade. But it was hard, and it didn't make sense to me really. But the bass guitar, somehow there was a connection there. I picked it up and I just kind of knew what to do with it. And I would just devote hours and hours every night. It was natural. I just knew what to do with it. And it was what I wanted to be doing, you know, more than anything, basically.
Right. And I think I'm sure you can identify as a parent now. Like I also have a 4-year-old kid, and I think it's one of those things in other conversations I've had with parents where the thing that you're most concerned about is your kid finding something that they're passionate about, you know? And I'm sure your parents, like once they saw how you took to bass, they were, you know, I'm sure in some respects they're like, oh, Steve finally found something. Like this is, or was it the opposite where they're like, oh, I don't know about bass guitar, Steve.
Yeah. I think it might be more the second.
Okay.
It was, you know, it was, it's hard. I know that it's difficult to, you don't know what you're, you know, you can only put so much into your children before they actually start becoming their own little person. And I guess I don't know that that's, I think my parents wanted me to be a cartoonist because I liked to draw a lot when I was a kid.
Interesting.
And the type of music that I was into in high school when I started learning how to play bass was probably not the path that I think my parents would have wanted to see me go down.
Right.
And so, it probably only got worse and worse, basically until Tony and I started playing together as Zombie. They've been big supporters of Zombie from the beginning, but I think it's safe to say that they probably hated every other band I was in.
Right. Yeah, I could see. Well, especially like you said, if there is that trade-off where you did something that they understood in regards to, you know, drawing and cartooning, and they're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Like, you can make a living off of that, but then...
Sure.
the moment that you pick up a bass guitar, that's when it's like, wait, that's your, no, we can't encourage that. So what
I mean, they didn't discourage it, but they were, you know, it was probably pretty tough for them to see, to, you know, who it was maybe, it probably looked like things are pretty up in the air,
sure.
You know, as far as where I'm going to come out of this.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
In reflection to your cartooning and drawing, like what were you... Was this something that you just kind of, you know, doodled and like you bought books from the local bookstore on how to draw people? Or was this something that just kind of, you know, came inherently and naturally?
It was more sort of a natural thing. I would just draw what I see, you know, like I was a huge fan of, Calvin and Hobbes and, you know, Bill Watterson, I thought was just like a genius, not just as far as the cartooning goes, but he's just such a smart guy and so interesting. And I sort of wanted to be him for a little while. But I'm colorblind, which makes things a little difficult as far as the arts go.
Right. That's a little roadblock.
Yeah. Yeah. It in the end, it proved to be a little bit too much, but you can play bass and not have any eyes at all.
Right. What did your parents do for a living as you were growing up?
My mom was home with us until I was, well, I guess until you know, until my younger sister was in school, and then she was an X-ray tech. My dad was a steel worker.
Oh, that's completely appropriate for Pittsburgh.
Pretty solid Pittsburgh upbringing, you know.
Right. Definitely working with your hands, learning a trade.
Steel workers, hospitals. That's Pittsburgh.
Right. And so then, like you said, after you picked up the bass guitar and you started to find this community, was it one of those things that you were kind of transitioning out of? Because I know you've mentioned in previous interviews, like, you know, Van Halen was a huge influence. So were you transitioning from kind of the, you know, grand, large rock bands to kind of the, like you said, the sort of more punk and hardcore world? Or what did you gravitate towards when you first started to get introduced to the independent side of things?
Well, I kind of found that stuff through... Well, you know what? I was kind of, you know, in Pittsburgh, we were kind of lucky. I think, honestly, my introduction to the world of independent rock was Don Caballero, who was, you know, from Pittsburgh and very popular. And even in high school, I had a lot of friends who were into them. And they were very musical, very technical, but still very heavy. And at the time, I was really into, I started high school in 1989. So, which was like kind of the golden age of, that was like right around the time when all the big thrash bands were peaking and putting out like the last records before they started to, you know, really suck.
Sure.
And so I was really into metal. I was really into that kind of thing. And Don Caballero was a nice bridge to the indie rock world, because they were still very heavy and aggressive, but with a real sort of, you know, artsy aesthetic to it.
Like you would say Don Caballero would be a nice transition band for you to be able to get introduced to more artistic, the more artistic side of the independent world.
More artistic and just like that. Through that's when I developed an interest in finding bands that people didn't know about. That became part of the charm, you know?
Right. Well, no, that's, I'm really glad that you put it that way, because there definitely is that that sense of finding your own band. You know, it's like you find a band that you introduce your friends to and they're like, whoa, what is this? And like, you wear that as kind of a badge of pride where it's like, yo, I did the work on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember, like, it was, you know, in high school, that was when Nirvana blew up. And I remember a lot of my friends who were just a little bit older than me, Nirvana played a show in Pittsburgh, a legendary show, like right before Nevermind came out. But it was 18 plus and I wasn't old enough to go yet, but I had friends that were old enough for that could get in. And for about 3 or 4 months, that was all I heard about, was this Nirvana show, until Smells Like Teen Spirit was on the radio every second of every day. And then, of course, everybody's just like, pretend that never happened. Move on. Yeah. Slint. That's who I like. Just kind of moved in the opposite direction.
I think that's a really important point, because I definitely think by nature, like, as a teenager, you're always kind of contrarian. You know, you're always trying to zig when people are zagging, just because you obviously are trying to carve your own lane.
This was a thing that, like, now kids aren't going to understand this now, but I remember the year that the football players started dyeing their hair and, you know, dressing like, you know, my friends dressed. And it was heartbreaking. You know, you're not like us. It was a little rough. It was a tough time to be a teenager looking for that thing, trying to find that thing to connect to. When you finally find it, and then everyone else in the world is co-opting it and taking it from you, and it's lost its meaning. So then you just have to look deeper. You have to dig deeper.
Right. It's true. It kind of becomes that sort of scavenger hunt for how weird your interests can get. Mm-hmm. And like, I definitely identify with that in the same fashion that I'm sure you probably started to dive even deeper into kind of, you know, films and the horror world and sort of the,
that stuff I was already into. I've been obsessed with John Carpenter since I was 8 years old and I first, you know, saw Halloween. Ever since then, you know, I bought the cassettes. I had CDs. It's weird talking with people now about my love of 80s synth rock and, you know, Van Halen and John Carpenter, because for me, there's never been this sort of rediscovery of that stuff. I have been fascinated and interested and fully into it ever since. I never stopped being into it. It's just everything kind of, you know, I'm not sure where I'm going with this. It's just always been a part of who I am. So to see people who are just discovering this stuff, like it's hard to imagine what that would feel like,
right?
Because it's part of my upbringing, you know?
Yeah, no, I can understand that. I mean, I'll use myself as an example, where it's like I'm 34 years old, and you know, while I haven't I haven't been as entrenched in it as you have in regards to, you know, I mean, whatever, when I first started to watch, you know, horrific movies, it was definitely when, you know, between the ages of 10 and 12, and then, but I still think there is that conceit of just like, what do you like, you're just now getting to this, like, and you're, yeah, you know, especially if you're over the age of like 30 and you're like, and you're just keying into this, like, this is weird. You should have found out about it by now.
Different world now. And sometimes it's hard to relate to the people that are super obsessive about this stuff now. You know, and I find out from, you know, I guess at the same time, like, kids who are 20 now could feasibly have grown up and this stuff could have been as big a part of their life as it was me, you know, simply because in like the 90s, if you came of age in the 90s, you might have just missed all that stuff completely. And before, you know, Napster and file sharing came along, there wasn't a way to access this stuff. There wasn't a way to become familiar with the band Goblin. I knew them because I saw Dawn of the Dead a million trillion times, you know, from the time I was, you know, a child. And it's just, they've always been part of my conscious, you know, the consciousness. You watch the movie at the end of the credits, you know, music by, you know, the Goblins. It's like, oh, I got to find out about them.
Right. And did your, in the same fashion as your, like you said, your parents were very concerned when you started to pick up the bass and get into all these fringe styles of music that they didn't understand. Did your parents ever kind of, you know, send up a signal flare of like, wow, like Steve's really watching a lot of weird movies. Like, should we be concerned about that?
Well, I think they did a good job. You know, they showed their concern, but at the same time they were supportive, and they were, you know, they didn't try to make me feel weird about being into that stuff, but you know, they were supportive. They were supportive without being really encouraging. You know, I think that's probably the best way to put it.
Right, right. I just know it's like it's definitely those few things that can set parents off from like, oh, right, like explicit music or you can't watch bad movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but back then there wasn't, you know, this was, you know, this is kind of even before cable TV, really. Where they would just be there would be, you know, in Pittsburgh, like I said, there was this sort of horror heritage. There were always, like, all the UHF television stations would run horror movies at night or on the weekends. So, like, you could still find that stuff, even if, you know, it wasn't like your parents would just not rent the movie for you, or they would, you know, block certain channels, or you weren't allowed online to watch these movies or something. They were just on TV.
Right. They had no choice. Yeah. There was no gatekeeper. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And I would, and like, as soon as I was old enough and my parents would let me, I got a TV in my room, and then that was it. That TV was never turned off. You know, I'd get home from school, turn on the TV. Anything else I did that night was sort of just supplemental to watching TV.
Right.
My childhood.
Did you, I guess, did you care about like school? Did you, you know, apply yourself, as teachers would say? Or was that something you were just coasting?
No, I definitely coasted. I did all right, but I could have done a lot better.
Sure. And did you have aspirations from a career perspective on like, oh yeah, so I guess I'll go to college and then I guess I'll do this thing? Or was there, once you kind of got introduced to music, that was how you wanted to figure it out?
No, it's interesting even now, because like when I'm working on a project, I get really, I'm very single-minded about it. It can sometimes be hard to focus on anything else. And now, like, looking back, I can see that, like, you know, even in high school, like, I didn't really even want to go to college. I just wanted to be in a band. I just wanted to find a band. And I knew that I could really apply myself. And I knew that if I could get myself into a good band, I knew that I had what it would take to be successful at it. And it took a lot of, it was like that the transition from high school to college was really difficult for me because I really only wanted to be playing music. It's all I wanted to do. You know, my parents were very supportive of that, but they also, you know, I wanted to go to school for music. But they were also very practical and, you know, encouraged me to be very practical about it and said, well, why don't you study music education? That way, you know, you graduate, you have the music, you have the actual music education, but you have a degree that is applicable, you know.
Right. Something we just want you to be safe, Steve. We want you to have something useful.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And you know, that makes total sense to me. It was the smart move, but the only problem there was that then having an education degree sort of put me on the wrong track for a while. You know, I graduated from college and it seemed like, well, you know, now I need to do something with this degree. So I was a substitute teacher for a year and it was not a good fit. And I know this, and I knew all my advisor, my professors at college knew this too, that there's the best teachers are typically people who really have to work for something. You know, like I was saying before, I just kind of understood music. It just makes sense to me. But I had classmates at college who had to work so hard to understand some of these, you know, what felt like to me just sort of basic concepts. And those are the students who now are, you know, very successful educators and, you know, tenured college professors, because they know what worked for them and they can explain it to their students. Whereas I just understood the stuff. I didn't know why. And so I couldn't explain that. I couldn't get that point across. Well, like, no, just play this.
Right. Yeah. You're like, no, that's simple enough. Right. Totally. Totally. Like, why don't you get this? Come on.
Just play the right note.
For sure. And so then.
So education wasn't the right route, but that kind of sidetracked me for a little while. I would say that the majority of my 20s were just sort of spent trying to figure out, you know, what to do with my life now that I've gotten this degree that I know that I never want to use.
Right. Yeah. You were just kind of floating unanchored anywhere. Yeah. So when did Zombie kind of come into your life? Was that like post-college, like you were mentioning?
Yeah, that was a few years. That was probably like 3 or 4 years after college. I started playing and, it just was the type thing where we sometimes things just make sense, and we got together and we started playing and it made sense. So we just kind of never questioned it until much later when we found ourselves like neither of us had jobs and we were living together in Chicago in a house with I was living with Tony and at the time his girlfriend, and it was a really like brutal scenario. It was sort of like this wake up call where I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. I've like really sort of painted myself into a corner here. At that point it's like, oh, okay. So now I've basically just been a touring musician for a couple of years now, but the kind of music that we were playing wasn't necessarily sustainable, back then. So there would be, you know, we could keep touring. We could just like, we would be out on the road and we'd get a call for another offer for the next tour and be like, yeah, let's do it. You know, we were like the band for a while there that a lot of the sort of bigger metal bands wanted to take us out because we were so different, somehow compatible, But we were not going to upstage anybody. We were just so radically different that, you know, kind of worry about having an opening band that's going to, you know, that's going to blow everybody away. And then you're going to come out and be like, yeah, so here's what we do.
Right.
But we were so different that there was no risk of that. So we would get asked out on so many different tours, and it was so fun to meet different people, you know, different genres of music and play for different audiences. But we were making like 100, 150, 200 bucks a night, and not really selling much merch, because let's face it, people bring their money to buy, you know, the CD and the t-shirt of the headlining band. So it was like we were doing it, but we were not really doing it. At that point, it felt like we were really making it, but at the same time, like I could very easily see how everyone else in my life and my family was probably looking at this as just like this ego thing, where we were really only doing it for ourselves because we weren't really benefiting from it, aside from getting our name out there, meeting people, making connections.
Right.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Well, you actually, you said something in a previous interview that really struck me in regards to just the idea of being unemployed and traveling. Like that's, like you said, that's essentially what you were doing. And I do think that is a notion that most people, I guess, don't have the wherewithal to really, I mean, I imagine probably due to the fact that, you know, you were obviously in your mid 20s. So you had maybe a little bit more perspective than a 17-year-old kid that starts to hit the road. But yeah, that's a notion that doesn't enter people's heads when they're touring, because they think as long as they're on the road, they're successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, some people are, and we definitely toured, we definitely opened with bands. And that was another thing that was difficult for us, was we would be touring, opening for bands who actually were doing quite well, and making quite a bit of money, and maybe at home had fewer expenses too, because they had been doing it longer. And so they kind of had their lives set up where, you know, you get home from tour and you're only home for maybe 2-3 weeks. And so you just live in a house with like 5 other guys and you just hang out when you're at home. But we didn't make enough money. So when we get home, we'd have to work. We'd have to try to find jobs. We couldn't cover our rent. Over the, you know, the course of maybe like the first 3 or 4 years of Zombie being together, I probably racked up close to $20,000 in credit card debt, just paying, trying to pay bills, paying credit card bills with other credit cards.
Right.
You know, all the gear that we had, you know, I had to charge groceries. I had actually no money at all. And so that's why, you know, there came a point where after, I guess around 2006 or so, it just really became too much and I had too much debt and I couldn't do it anymore. I went home and I got myself a couple jobs and I worked all the time for years, until I could pay off my credit card debt.
Do you remember kind of that moment? Cause everybody that's toured definitely has that moment in their head when, you know, whatever, like my moment is definitely like sitting in a bathroom in Montreal and being like, oh my God, I'm playing in front of like 30 people. What am I doing with my life? Like, do you have like a particular moment that kind of stuck out in your head where it was just like you said, I gotta wash this up and go home.
It was a really gradual realization. It wasn't like some light bulb eureka moment. I would find myself, you know, on stage or, you know, just in the corner of the room, as it were, most of the time, you know, set up performing and I'd be playing and all of a sudden it's, you know, you look up and you realize like, you know, holy shit, where am I? What am I doing? I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm thousands of miles from home. I'm thousands of dollars in debt. There are 12 people watching me do this. You know, is this worth, is my art this important? You know, I always like to use the quote from Scanners, you know, Benjamin Pierce, the artist, says, you know, my art keeps me sane. He was a famed scanner who had sort of been able to control his abilities. And I like to think that, you know, my art sort of kept me sane, but I think it actually drove me insane.
Sure. Well, I'm sure it, like, not the actual art creation itself, but then the process in order to promote said art, that's usually what, like you said, grinds people down to the point of where it's like, this isn't sustainable anymore.
Well, and it's not sustainable. And then you just start, it just started to feel icky. You know, I felt like, why is this so important to me that I get up in front of these people and play my synthesizers for them? You know, I couldn't stop analyzing things. And I guess that's probably that's the difference between, you know, being in a band and being on tour as an 18 or 20 year old versus being in a band and being on tour as a 28 or 30 year old, you know.
Yeah.
You can't look at it the same way. As much as you try, you just can only fool yourself for so long. And at the time, there was just no market for what we were doing in a live music.
You were unfortunately a few years ahead of your time.
we were great as the opening. We were a great opening band.
Yep.
But like every night playing, you know, like when we do, you know, like we did a tour with Dillinger Escape Plan, which you witnessed.
Yes.
And there was, you know, they would be clearing five times what we would make in just with merch sales.
Right.
And granted, there were more of them and they had massive expenses, but these guys were doing it. And to be so close, yet so far was really the most difficult part. You know, it looked like it was within reach to us, but the fact was we were never going to achieve that level of stability as a touring band. It just couldn't happen.
Yeah.
We were sort of led to believe that it could, simply just by association, we would tour with these bands that were successful. So it just really made us feel like we were successful.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's interesting. So like, yeah, by proxy, you felt like you could be in the same universe because they're your peers. But then once you sat down and saw the realities of it, it's like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah.
Until you're asked the band that you're opening for, like, oh, so what are you guys doing after the show? And they're like, oh, we're going to go get some hotel rooms and shower up. And it's like, what are you doing? It's like, oh, I don't know. I guess we're going to go out to the merch table and see if anybody offers us a place to crash. There were definitely shows where, you know, we'd be in cities where we've never been, and, you know, we just, you know, have to bite the bullet and get on the mic after our set and say, hey, so anybody have some room on their floor?
Totally.
Come see us at the merch.
You want to watch horror movies all night?
We're clean. We're friendly. We're nice. You know, we're
right. Yeah. You're just at that point, you're just shilling for yourself. You're just like, oh, this will be real easy. Like, we just need to use your showers. Hopefully you got some towels. Maybe you got a pillow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so then, you know, obviously, like, fast forward a couple of years, like you said, you were, you know, concentrated on working and obviously still creating music within the context of Zombie, but just not touring regularly. And then it seems extremely logical that you would obviously move on to, you know, scoring and composing and that sort of stuff. Was that basically kind of sprung out of obviously the work that you were doing with Zombie, or was that always kind of a desire that you held in your head? You just didn't know how to, I guess, execute it?
No, it's actually more diabolical than that. You know, when I was a kid, I always really loved film scores. I found them very powerful, and I was really into music, and I liked the idea that music could really have such an emotional impact on people, you know, even just as a supplementary thing to the visuals. And you know, like I said, I you know, people were, you know, some of my friends are really in, you know, into, like, you know, Led Zeppelin or whatever. I was really into John Carpenter. You know, that was who I loved. I had the you know, the Miami Vice soundtrack. Jan Hammer was, you know, I was really into that type of stuff. And typically the composers I liked were, you know, I started making the connection where, like, okay, the Jan Hammer, I really like Danny Elfman, you know, there are these guys that are doing these interesting, you know, soundtracks, and what do they all have in common? They were all in bands. You know, and I started putting two and two together, you know, Jan Hammer from Mahavishnu Orchestra, Danny Elfman, Oingo Boingo, you know, that's, you know, and then, you know, and then later Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo, you know, these guys all got into doing films, you know, by using their leverage as, you know, well-known musicians. And I knew that I didn't have the attention span to sit through music composition classes. I just didn't have it in me. So I thought, well, how I want to do it by being in a band. And then taking that route, you know, taking the Danny Elfman route, going the Mark Mothersbaugh route. And it only took 40 years to make that happen.
Right, right. Well, honestly, that's a very practical, like, kid-like. Well, I mean, that is very kid-like logic. Like, I see.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's beautiful because it's like that way. It's like, oh, this is how I can execute this in my, you know, whatever, 12 to 14-year-old brain. It's like, this is exactly how I can do this. So do you, is it one of those things, like, obviously, you know, there with you scoring The Guest, and a lot of attention was paid to you based off that fact. Are you still, I guess, for lack of a better term, like, do you feel legit in this world? Like, do you feel that you obviously have done enough to feel like, you know, cause obviously a lot of people that create art always feel like, oh man, I'm just fooling everybody. Like, you know, someone's going to tap me in the shoulder and be like, dude, you're not welcome here at any point. Do you still feel like you're in that? Or do you feel like, well, I've done enough stuff where I can be relatively proud of what I've done?
I don't know that I sometimes I wonder whether whether the years of touring and drug abuse and drinking and just not, sometimes I wonder if I've somehow permanently flipped the switch in my mind where I can actually just never, ever not be super critical of every decision I make in my life.
right.
I know, I see the incredibly nice things that people are saying about the scores that I've done, the music I've made, you know, but I just can't bring myself to believe it, because if I believed it, then it's like, then I've really made no progress at all. I have to be critical of myself and I have to question. Otherwise, then you're just going along with it. And to me, I feel like, you know, there was definitely a moment with Zombie where, like, I never questioned what I was doing because it felt right. But then when things kind of fell apart and Tony and I had been just touring, just the two of us in a van driving back and forth across the country, you know, 3 or 4 times a year. And we just like had nothing to say to each other anymore. We had just like run out of things to talk about. And there would just be like these just hours and hours of silence, you know, after a night of, you know, performing and drinking and smoking and then to wake up the next morning and have to drive, you know, 300 miles. I don't want to go back to that. Like there was an awakening there and I don't want to go back to the way I was before. You know, I don't want to just blindly follow my intuition. I need to be critical of myself and I need to question the decisions I make in life. And so I don't think that I'm legit. I think that I have a lot of work to do and I want to do that work. And the fact is, I don't know that I'll ever consider myself legit in any way. So it's kind of beside the point. If I somehow get, you know, tagged to score some massive sci-fi blockbuster, that might be one thing, but that's just, but that's just, you know, that's just money. That isn't what makes you legit in my mind. I feel like I'm doing what I wanted to be doing. And I don't know, I guess in that sense, that's legit.
Yeah.
I'm true. I feel like I'm being true to myself. And so legitimacy isn't the concern.
Really. Right, right. Yeah, you're not that's not the target because that's a moving target. You're simply trying to do the work that you know that you've prepared yourself for, you know?
Sure, sure. Well, and there is a bit of there is a resurgence now in you know, the interest in these old film scores and synthesizers in general, you know. But you know that I've already been doing this for 15 years. And so this might change. The interest might just move on and people are going to be back into banjos next year. Who knows? So I can't look at things like that, because just as quickly as this stuff came back into vogue, it could go right back out. And then I'm going to still have to be doing what I'm doing anyway.
Right, right. And so I've got two last things to hit you on and then I'll let you go. But obviously, like you said, with the resurgence and more people paying attention, I mean, it is bizarre, even to a person like me, who obviously isn't like creating in that world. But it's just so strange to see, and to see for me the parallels of, like, you know, whatever the punk hardcore DIY community and all the people, whether, you know, people that are releasing soundtracks from like Spencer to Death Waltz and Kevin at Waxwork, like all these people come from the same background as like what you and I did, where it's like, you know, playing punk shows at crappy venues or whatever. Anyway, it's just, it's bizarre. So, but have you seen, like, I'm sure you felt, I guess, more attention paid to you, or is it one of those things you, like you said, you're just trying to kind of keep your head down and do the work regardless of what's happening in the larger ecosystem?
Well, what people are saying about I do is not going to influence what I'm doing, because I was already doing it. You know, like if anything, it makes me feel a little weird now that there's so much, you know, maybe I'm just, you know, and then there's, you know, the self-doubt takes hold. And I think maybe I'm just actually being lazy. And maybe I chose this type of music to pursue because no one else was doing it. And so it was kind of like having my own little race only against myself, competing only against myself. But there's legitimate competition. You know, there are guys who have also been into this stuff forever who are now kind of, you know, getting the attention that they deserve as well. And I wonder if we're just all going to be, yesterday's news next year, or if somehow we're going to become somehow legitimate, and how will that make me feel if you know, this thing that I've considered sort of my own like personal conquest becomes a thing that, you know, the world is now interested in. You know, I looking at the reviews from all the film festivals recently, like people are really stoked when a movie has a synth score. What happens though if synth scores become the new norm? How will that make me feel? Will I just have to find something new to do in order to feel like an individual, or will I be able to continue being the person I've already been and be comfortable with that?
It's a good reflection, obviously, to have when everybody is kind of in the middle of a moment and mm-hmm. trying to like examine that moment and be like, yeah. Is this a wave that's crashing, cresting, whatever?
Exactly. I'm afraid to get too caught up in it because I don't want to crash with this wave. Yeah. Because I've already been in these waters and I know these waters, and I don't want to find new waters at this point.
Totally. You're like, I'm good with what I got here. This is fine.
Yeah.
The last thing I wanted to hit on, and this is a very sort of logistical question, and more so of my own curiosity, just because coming from. Like I've worked at record labels for years and like I've been involved in the music industry in some capacity for a long time. But the score composition world is like so foreign to me in the sense of like the logistics of setting it up. So is it one of those things where it's like, you know, do you yourself, I mean, obviously people know your work now to where I'm sure, you know, people are kind of approaching you and you can be a little more selective in your work, but how does it work where it's like, once you kind of get approached and a person like pitches you a job, is it one of those things where it's like they just pay you some flat sum of money and then you go off for months and then you return with the score? And like, you know, you don't have to get like super granular, but I was just, you know, I'm just very, very curious.
I don't know that I've done enough of it at this point for there to be, a typical way for it to work. You know, with Adam Wingard, with the guest, I've known Adam for a long time. I think I met Adam in 2004 or maybe even 2003, when Tony and I scored his first feature length movie as Zombie. And we did that because he approached us because he had read a review of our self-released CDR. This is before Relapse. He read a review of our CDR in Rue Morgue magazine. And and just thought that this was something that he thought would fit with his movie, and so he hired us to do his movie. We had zero experience at all, but it was another one of those things where we just kind of knew what to do from being, you know, so immersed in that culture. And Adam and I had kept in touch, and he was a fan of a couple of the albums I've put out on my own recently. And so for the guest, he kind of wanted music that was, you know, for references, he wanted music that sounded like the couple albums I've put out recently. So for me, it was more like I just got to make music that I would have wanted to make anyway, which has kind of been kind of been the same with the few scores I've worked on so far, where I really haven't people saying, okay, we're going to pay you to do this, and then supply the music, and then they give me suggestions, and I fine tune things until it fits the scene. And Adam is a very he's very musical. He's really into music and has a really sort of natural understanding of it, and so he has a lot of input and a lot of. You know, he had a lot of ideas to sort of like segues and building cues. You know, I like when directors have input. I feel weird when I'm working on something and the director says, yeah, here's the money, make me music, and you make the music and turn it in. And they're like, cool, thank you.
Right.
You know, because that's when, you know, when a director comes back and says, I need you to change this. This doesn't fit. This isn't working. You need to sync this up, time this up a little better. Then I know, like, okay, then it's real. Then it makes sense. Then it's like, okay, this guy knows what he's talking about. And so I trust his opinion. And, you know, it's like, and I've been in enough bands where it's a, it's a give and take. You know, you can't just get up and thrust your opinion on people and expect them to just accept it. You know, being in a band, you come up with a riff and someone says, well, why don't we play that a little bit differently? And it's like, okay, so working with the director, that's kind of what I want, who will kind of give me some suggestions and let me know that what I'm doing is working. And I don't know. I think I might have gotten off topic.
No.
I
understand what you're saying. I mean, in regards to like the collaborative process, like you wanted to, like you said, kind of mimic the idea of a band as opposed to like you just simply supplying like a quote unquote product, you know?
That's probably just me, you know, second guessing myself. You know, I'll come up with something that I think is really good. And then, but I would, it would make me feel more comfortable for the directors or producers to say, okay, this is good, but we need you to change this. Because then if I make that change, then I know we're good. But if people just accept what I write, then it's sometimes a little more difficult to be sure that I've done the right thing.
Right, right. You're like, just give me some slice of feedback. I just need something.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right.
But so far that hasn't been a problem. I've been lucky enough to work with typically directors who were either in bands or are just very into the music scene. Otherwise they would never have known about me in the first place. So it's been fun in that sense. You know, it kind of is a lot like being in a band, having that sort of creative back and forth.
That's super exciting. Cause yeah, like you said, it's comfortable enough to where you are, you're in a good creative space, but then obviously it challenges you to do something, that's slightly different each time.
Yeah. You got to check yourself, you know, or have someone else check you every once in a while. Otherwise, God knows what I'd end up doing.
Right, right. Well, Steve, I really appreciate you hanging out with me and chopping it up.
This was really great. Thank you.
So there you go. There was Steve. Consume his stuff. Check out Zombie. Watch The Guest. He also has an upcoming horror movie soundtrack called Cub that Relapse is putting out. I immediately pre-ordered it. I didn't even listen to a song, just immediately pre-ordered it. But thank you very much, Steve, for taking time out of your busy dad/composition schedule. I always want to make sure that you, the listener, are at the center focal point. This is a selfish endeavor. I love doing this show. I love getting to speak to these people. But it is a lot of work. And not only for myself, but my producer, Tom Richfield. It's a lot of work for him to put this together. But we realize the importance of it. And honestly, it's all for you, the listener. I know that sounds totally trite and cliche. It's really awesome and compelling and engaging for us to hear from you. So on that note, email the show, 100wordspodcast@gmail.com, and visit the website, 100wordspodcast.com. Without further ado, I will bid you adieu. Until next week, please be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.